Are you confused about real food and what's healthy and good for the planet? Do you need the facts about local, organic, and sustainable food? Well, get ready to change the way you eat. Get ready for The Appropriate Omnivore with Aaron Zober.
Hello, and welcome to another episode of The Appropriate Omnivore. I'm your host, Aaron Zober, and today, for February, we're going to be talking about World Kombucha Day, which will be taking place on Friday, February 21st. This is a holiday completely devoted to the wonderful beverage known as kombucha. Loyal listeners will be very familiar, as we've talked about it on this podcast plenty of times before. Many likely were also fans of it before tuning in and subscribed to us for that very reason. For newer listeners, here's your chance to learn about it. If it piques your fancy, you can then go back and listen to some of the older kombucha casts. Here to talk with me about kombucha is Hannah Crum of Kombucha Camp. Hannah, welcome back to the show. It's great having you here. This is now your fifth time, so just like Saturday Night Live has the Five Timers Club, I think we got to start a thing here on The Appropriate Omnivore for Five Timers.
Wow, thanks for having me back. I really appreciate it. Woo-hoo, first five-timer.
It's always a pleasure because I tell people that the blog is actually about fermentation. I mean, you know, sure, it's called The Appropriate Omnivore, so there's a part about meat, but really, we talk about all kinds of food. And if you think about it, fermentation is kind of a theme with everything because even with pastured meats, the whole thing with ruminants is the grass ferments in their stomach. So really, fermentation is the theme of this podcast, I'd say.
Well, you could say fermentation is a form of digestion that takes place outside of the body, right? So when we ferment things, what we're doing is exposing them to bacteria, yeast, we're inoculating them with microorganisms that then break them down into more easily digestible components. And often in that process, they're transforming potentially harmful elements into ones that are safe to consume. And then it's also enhancing the nutritional value because what they're excreting are vitamins and nutrients and things that really support our body.
And I know Kombucha Camp, obviously, with its name, kombucha is a big devotion, but you're also passionate and you have some involvement with other type of ferments too, right?
Yeah, well, we call ourselves bacteria farmers. And so we cultivate four cultures in specific. So kombucha, which is a tea and sugar ferment from Asia. We also do Jun or June, which is its raw honey cousin. It's starting to become more popular. And then we also do milk kefir and then water kefir, also known as Tibico. So those two share kefir as a common name, but they aren't actually related. They're very different. But in this case, kefir becomes a term of convenience because we ferment them in a similar fashion. So when I say term of convenience, for clarification, I mean like how we call peppermint tea, but it's not tea, which is Camellia sinensis. It's actually a Tizan. However, since we steep them in the same fashion, peppermint tea, everybody knows what you're talking about. So that's sort of how water kefir and milk kefir are actually not related, but related in that they share the same word.
Interesting. And of course, for people who have listened before, we've done, I think, a whole show just about the basics of kombucha camps. So we're not going to talk in depth, but for first-time listeners, give them kind of a log line of what Kombucha Camp is about.
Yeah, sure. So Kombucha Camp is the top information site in the world for kombucha information. It started in my home as a little workshop that you could take and has evolved into an online resource, several YouTube videos on our YouTube channel. We also then wrote the Big Book of Kombucha, which is a 400-page tome that came out in 2016 and continues to be a really popular book in the space, very comprehensive. And then in 2014, as an outgrowth of our broader mission of changing the world one gut at a time, my husband Alex and I founded Kombucha Brewers International. So the trade association represents all commercial kombucha brewed around the world. We started with 40 member brands in 2014. We're up to about 400 worldwide. And we can't help but feel a little personally responsible for how popular kombucha has grown through all of our numerous educational and outreach efforts. So we're really excited to see it cresting $1 billion in sales in the U.S. already and $2 billion globally. And it just keeps growing.
And now there's World Kombucha Day. So how did that originate?
Absolutely. So World Kombucha Day, you know, as all good ideas, sometimes you get an idea, but you don't have the opportunity to flesh it out in that exact moment. So World Kombucha Day is the brainchild of Alex. When our book was going to be released in March of 2016, he thought of this as a way to sort of launch our book and create an opportunity to educate everybody about kombucha because we're so passionate about it. Unfortunately, at that time, we just didn't have the resources available to do so. And so what we did see is, of course, it's a great opportunity to educate everybody about kombucha. And much like your first kombucha, Aaron, was probably one that you bought at the store. So a lot of people, myself included, how we may have had our first kombucha was because we sampled it at a store or we heard about it and we bought it at the store. And so we really see this as an opportunity for people to learn more about kombucha, to try it at the store, and then, of course, to get excited about it and come find more resources on the web about it. So the date of World Kombucha Day is February 21st. Now, how did we get to that date? Kombucha has mythological origins in Asia. Well, we think it does come from Asia, China potentially, right? Tea originates in China.
Where a lot of things come from.
Yeah, exactly.
A lot of things originate from China. Spaghetti.
Spaghetti, what, the movable press, like there's so many things. Fireworks, gunpowder, I mean, you name it, it probably came from Asia, right?
Exactly.
And so kombucha is likely one of those things that came from Asia. And so the most common story we hear on the interwebs is that it originated in China in 221 BC. So 221, if we were to write that as a date, February 21st.
Aha.
So February 21st is World Kombucha Day. We're excited that it's in 2020 because I think actually all the twos sort of work to our benefit in making it.
Oh, yeah. And then next year, even better.
Yeah, it'll be 221-21. Exactly right. So what are you going to do to celebrate World Kombucha Day?
This podcast is part of it. And also putting some stuff up on social media, put some good stuff up on Instagram.
Absolutely. And are you going to drink a kombucha?
Oh, well, I've been drinking kombucha for this long time. And kombucha was something that was big when I first started doing The Appropriate Omnivore. And it's gotten even bigger. I'm amazed at how big it's gotten. I mean, I still see new kombucha brands at the supermarket every year. It just keeps expanding. What do you think is the reason that the market is able to grow and grow still a decade later?
So first of all, GT's is going to be celebrating their 25th anniversary this year. So commercial kombucha has been available for 25 years, but it used to only be available in Los Angeles, which is where you and I happen to be.
Yes.
I truly think of kombucha as sort of 21st century yogurt, and hear me out on this.
Makes sense.
Right, yogurt was like a hippie thing. You had to make it at home.
Right.
It was a counterculture, if you will. Enjoy the pun there. And then Dannon decided to market it as a commercial product. And in sort of the, you know, 70s, 80s, they had these great commercials, you know, showing old people in the old country living to be really old. Why? Because they ate yogurt. So they were really able to commercialize the product, and it has grown into a multi-billion dollar industry as a result. Everybody knows what yogurt is. It's a normal thing on your shopping list. Nobody questions the safety of yogurt. Right. And the reason I bring that up is because people will often be like, oh, is kombucha safe to drink? Right. Like, because
oh,
they
yeah.
aren't as familiar with it, they get really
that.
Freaked out by it because it looks weird. Exactly right. But just like yogurt, it's incredibly safe. In fact, all fermented foods, as you already know, Aaron,
right.
are incredibly safe because of the bacteria, the acids. You know, that's how come humans have been able to pass these around for millennia. Is because they are inherently safe. So I think of kombucha as the 21st century yogurt.
I like that. They're safe, and I think that we will actually one day look back and see pasteurization as one of the biggest mistakes.
Oh my gosh, you are so speaking my language here. 1,000% agree. What pasteurization does is allow for bad practices to proliferate, right? Especially you and I, we both love raw milk.
Right.
Pasteurized milk often has all kinds of yucky crud in it. This is why there's been such a backlash, I think, to the dairy industry, is because their unsanitary practices lead to products that then have a negative impact on human health. And when we rob our bodies of access to those bacteria that help us to process the lactose naturally, that's when, you know, so many people are having these issues. And you see the rise of sort of the non-dairy milks, which have their own issues. as well, just in terms of monoculture and factory farming and things like that.
And there are other problems, too, with plant-based milks. A lot of them have sugar as the second ingredient. There's also a lot of synthetic vitamins added into it and other ingredients. And all this is because we believe the dairy is bad, whether it's because we think the cholesterol is awful or, as we were talking earlier, the pasteurization. And I've heard that supposedly Louis Pasteur on his deathbed actually said that pasteurization was wrong. Have you heard that?
Well, so what I've heard is that he said this in French, ce n'est pas le microbe, c'est le terroir. It's not the microbe, it's the environment in which it's in, which completely goes against germ theory, which has been clung to tenaciously since the 1850s. Because basically what it does is it acknowledges that pleomorphism, which is an alternate concept that Bichamp, who was a contemporary of Pasteur, championed. And in fact, Pasteur plagiarized Bichamp, and you know, they were sort of contemporaries who had competing viewpoints. And if anyone's really curious, they can read Bichamp versus Pasteur to find that information. But that is what I heard. He recanted the whole germ theory on his deathbed and acknowledged that, in fact, it was the environment. And so I think what that speaks to, though, is sort of one bad apple ruins the whole bunch. It metaphorically, I think it makes a lot of sense because we see how it plays out in a lot of different ways. And it also speaks to the fact that, you know, you might have a certain type of chemistry within your body, and that will make your body stronger, versus if you have a different type of chemistry, that makes you weaker and more vulnerable and susceptible to invasion by other organisms. And so being conscientious about what we're putting in our bodies, on our bodies, making sure that we're not damaging our microbiomes. Obviously, sometimes we have to take antibiotics or things like this, but if we're constantly consuming a wide variety of different toxins, we may be unwittingly damaging our microbes, therefore harming our immune system.
I remember one time you put a dunce cap on Louis Pasteur at one of your presentations. I always loved that.
We could have a whole podcast just on Louis Pasteur, but since we're talking about World Kombucha Day, yeah. I hesitate to get too far down that rabbit hole. But to your point, these fermented foods, which have been passed on for so long, inherently are strong because of their defense mechanisms. And if we apply that same thought process to the human body, one of my common things I like to say is that humans are bacteriosapiens, because I feel that term encapsulates more closely the close relationship we have to bacteria, not just the ones that live inside of our body in our microbiome, which is sort of this new organ that was discovered about a decade ago as part of the Human Microbiome Project, but also our external microbiome. And so shaking hands or kissing on the cheek or sharing from each other's cups or eating a bite after somebody else had a bite, all of these things help us to pass on minute amounts of bacteria. And when you go through your immune system, which is through your oral cavity, right, it starts in your mouth and it goes through your gut, then your body has a chance to work with the organisms that you're taking on board and can naturally build defenses against them. And so this is where being in contact with other humans, with animals, with soil, these are really crucial, because these are traditional methods by which humans inoculated themselves, whether they knew it or not, right? Like mud baths and, you know, all the different ways that humans interact with their environment actually helped to create more diversity, which created stronger force fields.
As you said before, this is all about World Kombucha Day, so I think you'll like what I'm about to get into next, which is we're talking about the constant growth of kombucha. And last year I had on Nick Angulo, who created the Kombucha Festival in San Diego, and he thought one of the reasons that kombucha keeps growing is because, like we talked about, getting people from going to buying it at the supermarket to making it at home, it's that a lot of these kombucha companies start actually with home brewers, and then they decide they want to go into a business. So do you think that's part of why it's expanding continually?
We very much mirror the craft beer industry. The first slew of keynote speakers we had at KombuchaCon, which is coming up, our annual conference in April in Long Beach, came from the beer industry. And that's what everybody says to us. Oh, you're just like us 30 years ago, however many years ago. And I think what the common thread here is that the craft brew industry started in people's garages. Mm-hmm. When Charlie Papazian started his crusade to make home brewing legal in all 50 states, right? So at Prohibition in 100 years ago, they basically said nobody can make any alcohol at home for personal consumption. And yet you had all of these hobby beer brewers who really loved it and they didn't want to be illegal. And so out of that desire to legalize this hobby, people were making beer in their garages and now they were experimenting with different styles. And this directly led to the craft beer industry. And here we are 30, 40 years into that whole cycle, and we're back to the same number of breweries we had before Prohibition, which is over 7,000.
Wow, I didn't know that.
Right? Yeah, it took 100 years for the whole industry to bounce back because that's how many people were negatively impacted by Prohibition. And so the same type of thing, right? You have this love of brewing, you're brewing at home, you're experimenting with flavors, you're sharing with friends, you're getting feedback. Now you're going out, you're buying commercial brands, you're tasting theirs, you're trying to create unique flavors. And so there's just this love of the uniqueness of the product, of the fermentation process, of how fun and creative and diverse it is. And all of that just feeds together. And so, you know, just like those folks who love craft beer and are making it in their garages, they're also going out and buying craft beer and enjoying it because it's for the love of the craft. And that's what kombucha is. It's a craft beverage. And so I think that is truly why we're seeing it proliferate. And then you combine that with the current trends of people trying to reduce their alcohol consumption, their sugar consumption, increase their probiotics, looking for more functionality out of their food. They're not just wanting the same old dead sodas and, you know, chemically energy drinks. And that's where I think kombucha is this sort of drink of the 21st century. And so our mission at KBI this decade, you know, in the 2020s, is to make kombucha a household name. And so back to your earlier question about, can it just continue to grow? Why do we see it growing so much? And I think the answer is because we barely have 5 to 10%, you know, household penetration. Like, so many people still haven't heard of kombucha. As much as we're saturated with it here in Southern California, West Coast, Oregon, you know, you go to major cities. I think some of the other big states would be Florida, Texas, Colorado, New York. And we're starting to see it fill in everywhere else as well. But it still doesn't have that same notoriety in a bad way, or fame in a good way. And so I think there's just a lot more consumers we can bring to the category. And that's not even to talk about how much it's proliferating in Australia, New Zealand, which has probably the highest per capita number of breweries to population, just because those are much smaller places. Canada, of course, to the north, and Europe is really growing strong as well. And we're even hearing about it proliferating in Africa and the Middle East. And so really, kombucha always has been a global phenomenon, but it was something that you had to make at home. Somebody had to give it to you, sort of like a chain letter. You had to hear about it and be in the club to participate. And now it's something that people are really seeing has so much great nutritional value, flavor options, and fun that we're seeing it really explode everywhere.
I like that analysis. I think it makes sense that it's a lot because there hasn't been that much of kombucha. For instance, we don't see a big expansion of cookies because there already are a lot of people making that. But I think if you look at other foods that I also see as having expanded, and they also do start from the homemakers, I think of sauerkraut, ghee, and bone broth as other ones which are expanding. And I think you could say that's for the same reason. Well, they're really, so far, just a small part of the market.
And they're fairly easy to produce with lower cost ingredients.
Right.
Right? Like sauerkraut, cabbage. Yeah. Cabbage and salt, right? Thyme, of course. And, you know, you put in a bunch of other veggies to make it fun, or spices, and that's exciting. You look at bone broth again, like, bones are something that people typically just throw away. We've lost the habit of making our own bone broths at home in order to, you know, get through the winter season to rebuild that gut lining. And so now we buy our bone broth. And I love the cafes and places that sell it in the coffee cups because, you know, it's just as good, if not better, than a coffee. To enjoy a bone broth, especially on a cold day.
And we're seeing that too with kombucha. I'm seeing now some kombucha tap rooms.
Oh, yeah. So I truly believe the sustainable model for the industry is going to be a lot of small family-owned or friend-owned businesses. We see a lot of women-owned businesses, or women and, you know, husband and wife partnerships in the industry. We also, I think, are going to start to see more underserved communities.
I would love to see that.
Well, and I think there's a real opportunity, and this is definitely something that's on my radar for KBI. It's sort of a seed at this point. It's a dream, it's a vision, and how exactly that will get executed. I'm calling that into manifesting that, but I truly think that, you know, we're a nation of inflammation. Whether you're getting inflamed from low quality food, poison in, you know, the water, the air, right? We still have lead in the water in Michigan, fluoride's a neurotoxin. The list goes on and on, right? There's no end to the number of toxins that are permitted that then lead to autoimmune disease. And of course, it might not be one, but it's in combination. And so how do we get at this inflammation quickly? Well, I'm excited to say at KombuchaCon this year, we're going to have a follow-up study. We had a pilot study presented last year about the impacts of kombucha on stress markers. And sort of the short version of the information is that there's a fairly immediate impact when you consume kombucha to reduce those markers of stress in the body. And so I've always flipped this little meme on its head and said, drink kombucha and keep calm. You got to drink the kombucha first, because you're not going to keep calm unless you're reducing the stress. And, you know, really what's the root cause of all dis-ease is stress. And stress can be in the form of a bad diet, not have enough resources, an intense lifestyle, right? So stress of any form is going to lead to too much cortisol, is going to lead to breaking down the immune system. So I think that that's the real value proposition for anyone who's looking to find an opportunity. Now, here's the thing. I'm not going to lie. It's a lot of work. Labor of love, emphasis on the labor. But if you want to connect with community, if you want to provide nutrition, and it's not just kombucha, it's any fermented food business, or to your point, bone broths and things like this, you know, getting nutrient-dense foods to people where they live at prices they can afford, I think is really crucial. And I'm not saying we need to underprice these products. Rather, if they're fresh, if there's a small radius of where they need to be distributed, you can keep your costs lower because you're not shipping it across the country or, you know, out of the country and things like that.
And I think also supply and demand, as this becomes a more popular item, there'll be more demand. They can make a lot and they're selling more, so they don't have to charge as much for each individual one. I also see that as a big part of my blog is about knowing all the new products. And I do see very different prices for this kombucha that's been around the market for a few times. And I'll see this new one and like, wow, they're charging a lot more.
So here's the thing, right? There's economies of scale. And then there's also competing in the marketplace with national brands. National brands are always going to have more pressure to keep the prices lower because they're trucking their product across 50 states or whatever they're doing. And so they're always going to have a desire to keep up with each other. And then when you add to that the fact that there are certain manufacturing processes where brands will create a kombucha base. So this is like a kombucha that's been fermented almost to vinegar, not quite there by a technical definition. It's then diluted with water. Non-fermentable sweeteners are added, such as stevia, and then flavorings, right? And so that type of product has a longer shelf life. It's often pasteurized as well. They have the low calorie label on it. And while it is traditionally fermented to create that base in the first place, it's not as far as soda, right? I don't think it's as far as soda, but it is different than a product that isn't as shelf stable because it's still fermenting in the bottle. So it's a very different type of product. And I think there are consumers for all of these products. They all have different flavor profiles and people have different needs for why they're seeking the product out. So it's not to say that one is better than the other, but when you have a process like that, that you can execute on a mass scale, like other processed foods, that's going to naturally drive the price down. And so when you have these small regional local brands who are at your farmer's market, they're not executing that. They're not using a kombucha base. They're actually fermenting with culture, with SCOBYs. You're getting that really fresh product that's local to you. And so their price point is going to be higher because they don't have that same advantage. Because most of the people using those types of bases are large companies, whether they're, you know, owned by Pepsi or Coke or other food manufacturing brands. Those are the people who are more prone to use those bases because they don't have a history of fermentation. They don't understand how to work with the culture in that way. So they use these other techniques to create their products.
We have seen a lot of that across all of the spectrum of natural foods. A lot of these larger companies are now buying these startup natural food companies in all kinds of items. And what do you think about that?
Yeah, I mean, I think on the one hand, how are we going to create culture change? My hope is from within, right? Like, I grew up drinking Coca-Cola, and I still have an emotional connection to it as a child. I don't drink it anymore, or I drink a Mexican Coke if I can find it, because I want the sugar, not the high fructose corn syrup.
Yeah.
But, you know, Coca-Cola started out in a pharmacy. It had actual essential oils and other ingredients to it that may have had a health benefit at one point in time. How do we bring the system back to traditional fermented sodas, to providing beverages that have a nutritional value and aren't full of aspartame and other sort of nasty chemicals in them, high fructose corn syrup and whatnot? My hope is that you do it by these brands absorbing or purchasing, you know, fermented food companies. The problem, though, is sometimes that they'll go in and they'll try to cut corners or streamline processes. You know, I'll give you an example. I love Farmhouse Cultures. They sell kraut juice. Not that I don't love sauerkraut, but there's just something about getting that sour hit, and I really love it.
Oh, it's great, the shot.
Exactly right. Well, I bought a bottle not too long ago, a couple weeks ago, and I'm drinking it. I'm like, oh, this tastes a little different. And I look at it and it says vinegar is in it. So, you know, and I get it. It's hard. Like, if people aren't eating the sauerkraut, where do you get the juice? You have to find some way to make more juice. and unfortunately, that means leading to these types of processes. And again, it doesn't mean that the product isn't good or doesn't have a value for you. But I do feel like, oh, man, I wish I had just the kraut juice, because that's really what I wanted.
Yeah, I think it depends all how the company handles it. Like, for instance, I like with General Mills, they've purchased a number of organic companies, and I do see them actually doing a promotion of regenerative agriculture. So it's not just about taking the product and wanting to water it down or simply just cover all bases. I think some of the companies do truly believe in the mission of what they're buying.
Well, and Farmhouse Culture got bought by General Mills, so.
Oh,
right,
they were
to your
one
point.
Of them. Did, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. They were one of them. How you could tell is when they started making Farmhouse Culture chips.
Yes.
Right. They started like spraying the chips with the yummy probiotic. And it's a clever way to get more people into it, for sure. And so I think there's a real opportunity to combine traditional foods with innovation to create novel products. And this is what we see in the kombucha space. So I mentioned earlier Jun or June, which is kombucha's raw honey cousin. Now, of course, you go to the interwebs, you're going to find lots of mythical origins for Jun. But the reality is it's a culture very similar. It's uniquely adapted to harmonize with the organisms present in raw honey. It has a delicious floral flavor. The national brand you might see is called Wild Tonic. But, of course, there's loads of local brands as well. And then the other innovation we see is, of course, hard kombucha. So there's sort of two versions of hard kombucha. One is what we would call like a traditional kombucha that just is allowed to have whatever its natural ethanol content is, right? Like all fermentation creates ethanol for a very specific reason. Ethanol is antimicrobial, right? Think about when you fall down, you get a scrape. What do? You grab the rubbing alcohol and you do it to disinfect the wound, right? So alcohol has been used for a long time as a disinfectant. So yeast are so clever, they create ethanol as a way to prevent other organisms from colonizing the delicious substrate that they are present in, be that, you know, malted grain for beer or tea and sugar for kombucha, etc. So that's the first thing that happens is ethanol gets created. Now with kombucha, because it is a vinegar fermentation, it takes that ethanol and turns it into acetic acid. And so you'll see that process repeated. Think of wine vinegar and balsamic vinegars and apple cider vinegars. You know, that apple cider isn't juice at the store. It's hard cider, right? It's allowed to turn into hard cider, create alcohol, and then that's what's converted into those acids to give it that tangy flavor. Same with kombucha. Just we're harvesting it sooner so that we aren't consuming vinegar, which would be difficult to enjoy as a beverage, but we're also getting the benefit of that. Now, here's another way in which ethanol is valuable for us, and that is it thins the blood and makes it easier for your body to absorb the nutrients. And when we remember that when we're consuming ethanol in these traditionally fermented foods, be it kefir or kombucha or sauerkraut or kvass, it's in a matrix with nutrients that helps support a healthy body. It's in a matrix with other organic acids that support a healthy body. And so it's different from, say, distilled alcohol like vodka, or different from, say, a pasteurized beer, right?
Right.
Or filtered beer, where those organisms are removed. And now you're creating alcohol as a controlled substance, which actually does have a negative effect on the body. And so, you know, the confusion, of course, comes in when you have an arbitrary law created at Prohibition designed to collect tax money that is not rooted in any formal science or information. And so this is how the United States ends up with alcoholic beverages are considered at 0.5% and higher. Well, intoxication doesn't occur there. Harm to the human system doesn't occur there. But because of this old holdover, people are confused, right? They just assume, oh, well, if it's over 0.5%, it's alcoholic, therefore it's toxic, which just is not accurate.
Yeah, and I know at one time that kind of hurt kombucha.
Well, I mean, it actually strengthened it.
Oh, it did? Oh, interesting.
Well, so no such thing as bad press. It did hurt people financially, but it also helped elevate its profile. And, you know, it really made the true believers get even more excited about the category. And again, it just put the word out there. But it has, unfortunately, this issue has been utilized by some brands to try to create disharmony in our industry because they want to say, oh, there's something wrong with this product because there's trace amounts of alcohol. And my assertion, which is just rooted in logic, is, okay, well, if this were a real issue, right, if we really had an issue with, like, this alcohol is causing problems, we'd already see the results of it. Because how many families are making kombucha at home? It's full strength. They don't even notice because you can't get drunk from it. So their children are drinking it, pregnant women are drinking it, and everyone who's consuming it is safe because it doesn't have the same negative effect as if we were talking about distilled ethanol in the same quantities.
Yeah, you don't see people getting a DUI for kombucha.
Exactly right. You know, and that's sort of the fear, because you go to these countries where they have zero tolerance laws and they're like worried about that kind of thing. And so then you have, you know, brands that have to overfilter or they have to execute several processes in order to prevent the alcohol, when really what we need to do is better understand how this stuff is interacting with our bodies instead of taking this sort of black and white view, which, as you and I know, and lots of people know, the world is not black and white. It is so many shades of subtle and gray. And really, it's about observing, right? You know, people go, well, the science is settled. But think about this, right? Science isn't anything. Science is a scientific method. It's a method of inquiry whereby you look at observable phenomena and try to understand the underlying mechanism. So what we think of as science are people who have executed experiments up to this point. This is what we have been able to figure out, our underlying mechanisms, but it doesn't mean we even have half a concept of what things truly are. And I think we see that in that, right? We could go old, like blood types. We didn't know there were different blood types. You would get a transfusion. Some people would die. Some people would live. We figured out there's blood types. Oh, here's why we can't mix different blood types. You go more recent and you look at quantum physics, right? Einstein had theories that he wasn't able to prove, but that quantum physics has been able to prove. And you go even beyond that, right? Like an atom can be in two places at once, right? Like all these things that we assume are impossible are actually possible, even if they're paradoxical. And so that's all I want to say, is that science is an inquiry. It's a method of inquiry. Of course, there's information we get from that inquiry, but it doesn't mean that it's the end, because we can continue to see these phenomena play out. And it's our desire to better understand those phenomena that even prompt us to want to study it in the first place.
As I've heard, you can replace science with better science.
Exactly right. I totally agree with that. You can always replace it with better science.
And you're talking just a little bit earlier about the whole alcohol issue with kombucha, but also you mentioned even earlier in the show that more people are drinking kombucha as they're trying to drink less of what really the alcohol is. Now, I know we just passed January, which I never heard of before this year, but apparently some people celebrate January as dry month. So has there been anything of seeing the sales of kombucha boom in January?
All right. And there's like three other points I have to make about alcohol really quickly. Okay. So the first one is, so when we were talking about hard kombucha, there's one type that's actually, you know, probably a 1-3%. And that's going to be a traditionally fermented kombucha. There's no external yeast added to yield a higher alcohol content. Those are very unlikely to actually inebriate you. You might get a nice gentle buzz. A lot of times that's from the B vitamins present in kombucha. You know, people who get B vitamin shots have the same sort of euphoric feeling, but there isn't intoxication where you're physically incapable of operating machinery and things like that, right? Then we have hard kombucha, Where now what they're doing is they're doing a kombucha fermentation, except they're taking yeast known to yield a higher alcohol content and adding that into the fermentation process. So they have to take yeast not native to the kombucha culture, called a SCOBY, and put that into their product in order to get that higher alcohol content. The other thing I wanted to say about alcohol and traditionally fermented kombuchas with that lower range is that actually kombucha tends to curb cravings for alcohol. So many people report that when they start to include kombucha on a regular basis, their cravings for things like wine and harder liquor go down. I have a theory about that, but let's not go there. And then, you know, why then, if you're seeking to lower your alcohol, would you choose a hard kombucha? Well, because even when you're consuming alcohol these days, consumers want a product that is better for you. And kombucha is known to have probiotics. It's known to have healthy acids. And so if you get that plus a buzz, well, hey, bonus, right? But to your point about January and October, so those are sort of like two dry months.
October, interesting.
Yeah.
So didn't know that one.
January and October are your dry months. But yeah, kombucha mocktails or low alcohol kombuchas, those end up becoming really popular that time because it has so much flavor. It's so unique. It mixes really well. It almost tastes like a cocktail, but without the alcohol.
I think there's a lot of stuff we can do in January because there's also New Year's resolutions maybe people are doing also to cut sugar cravings. And I know you've done before the 30-day kombucha challenge in January. And I did that article that I wrote about it, which still is one of my more popular articles.
Well, I think we're going to launch it next year. Unbeknownst to us, a couple years ago, Pepsi bought Kavita. They declared January 15th is a National Booch Day. So that's specific to the U.S., but slowly started to catch on. And now we have World Kombucha Day. So my thought is, come next year, we're going to launch, because it's just about 30 days between the 15th and the 21st. I think it's perfect time to launch another 30-day kombucha challenge within that month. To your point, New Year, trying to eat better, letting go of all the holiday junk food, curbing your sugar cravings. I think it's going to fit in perfectly there. So look for the 30-day kombucha challenge next year between National Booch Day and World Kombucha Day.
Oh, I'm excited for that. And I know another part of World Kombucha Day, which you were saying earlier, is about getting people to make it themselves instead of where they may have been introduced to it in the supermarkets. So what advice would you give to people who want to brew their own kombucha for the first time?
Well, quality over quantity every day of the week. I mean, that's with anything you put into your body, and that applies to your cultures too. Now, can you grow a kombucha SCOBY from a bottle of kombucha? Yes. To what degree you're successful will depend on which kombucha you've chosen. Is it a traditional one? Is it flavored? And as I've mentioned before, there's a lot of processing they're executing. So it's a really great experiment to just sort of test your kombucha. But many people find that sourcing an authentic culture, whether that's from a friend or a reputable source, and of course, if you don't have a friend making it, Kombucha Camp can be your reputable source. And in fact, we are a reputable source that many kombucha brands will use Kombucha Camp culture, or that's where they started with, or they continue to use it. So we're really proud of that fact. We love helping people to take their homebrew passion into a commercial version. But right, back to the homebrewers. Grab our book, The Big Book of Kombucha, watch our videos, get our culture, and you will have 100% success. Why? Because we also offer customer support and our cultures are guaranteed to brew. You can find cheaper stuff out there, but they may not have the same support. They may not be big enough, etc. Again, you do you, but just know that if you're having issues, come find Kombucha Camp. We'll be happy to help you with our quality cultures and ingredients.
We've been talking about how kombucha keeps growing. Where do you see kombucha, say, 10 years from now?
Yeah, so by 2030, where do we see kombucha?
Sure.
Oh my gosh, just saying 2030 feels weird.
Yeah. What year did I pick to ask that question that it becomes a different decade? Well, actually, it always would be for 10 years, but it would be like the start of a different decade.
Right. Yeah, I think we're going to see a really strong industry that covers all continents. We're going to see a lot more people who are in tune with all of these fermented foods and things, who start to reject the foods of commerce, who reject these cheap ingredients, who reject monoculture and non-regenerative agriculture. I think that's what we're going to see in the next decade. And kombucha just is a piece of that puzzle. So we always think of kombucha not as an endpoint, but as a gateway. So kombucha might be the first first fermented food you've ever tried. Probably because you just didn't realize chocolate, yogurt, all these other things are already fermented that you might eat on a regular basis. Salami, cheese, things like that. But kombucha can be that entryway for people to learn about fermentation, to understand the microbiome. Also, fermented foods tend to be somewhere people who don't feel good turn to because they've tried other things. Those things haven't helped. And now they're switching it up to fermented food. So I truly think that we're going to see a really dynamic, robust community of fermentationists all over the world, not just with kombucha, but also, look, weird stuff like natto is starting to be talked about more. And, you know, my good friends, the Shakis, have written so many books on all different kinds of weird, wonderful ferments, of course, inspired by Sandor Katz, who's sort of the godfather of the fermentation revival back in the 90s. And I think we're just going to keep seeing that proliferate as more science, more information, more research validates that which we're, those of us who already consume these products experience, which is how they support our health. And so, you know, it may not be you catch a cold, you have a fermented food and it goes away faster, but you might not even catch that cold in the first place. Or if you do catch it, you catch a much milder version. So a regular, consistent consumption of a wide variety of fermented foods just makes you stronger and makes it so that your body's more resilient to illnesses in the first place. So, you know, staying resilient is sort of the first step of staying healthy. And we do that through all of these different types of foods. So that's where I see kombucha in 10 years, is being that household name, being on everybody's grocery list, being available in numerous communities, creating a financial opportunity for many, many people in their local communities, and really, again, bringing community back together. I think one of the things we miss so much, or that appears to be missing on online communities, is that in-person connection. And we can get so polarized and be screaming from our towers. And again, I think inflammation has a lot to do with that. And the more fermented foods we have into the food supply, the healthier, the happier, the saner, the calmer, the more constructive as opposed to destructive I think we'll see humanity become. So that's our mission, changing the world one gut at a time. We can't do it alone. We do it in symbiosis. We do it with friends like you, Aaron, to help us get the message out there. And of course, with all of our friends who are brewing kombucha, be it at home, commercially, etc. And of course, we hope that if you're looking to jump from a home brewer to commercial, you come to KBI, Kombucha Brewers International, you come to Kombucha Con, you get consulting help from Kombucha Camp, you get your cultures from us, you know, whatever it is. We're here to help service you, elevate you, so that you can elevate your community.
Do you think we can see kombucha served at baseball stadiums anytime?
Oh my gosh. I mean, it's already being served at football stadiums. So yeah.
Really? Which one?
Seattle Seahawks.
Oh, okay. Well, Seattle. That makes sense. Exactly right. But that seems like a C4.
I would love, those sponsorships are really expensive, right? I would love for kombucha to supplant Gatorade at some
point. Oh, yeah.
Well, because like, I love you that think too. Of the weird chemical dyes that are in there and all the stuff that's not good for you in those products. And it just would be great to replace it with actually healthy products. But those things cost money. And so we just need a stronger industry to have the funds in order to do that.
I know Sally Fallon said one of the things she'd like to see before she dies is a non-GMO kombucha being served at baseball parks. So it's football, but I have to mention that to her to see if is that close enough.
I think it counts.
I think
we're
so.
We're getting there. We're getting closer.
Well, hey, maybe the Mariners, too, nearby, they can take note.
Absolutely.
Going back to the overall theme of the show of World Kombucha Day, tell the listeners what they can do to help promote World Kombucha Day.
To help promote World Kombucha Day, first of all, use the hashtag World Kombucha Day. We know that several brands are going to be offering either free kombucha or free samples. So hit up your favorite brand. Say, hey, what are you doing for World Kombucha Day? Find out what their promotion is. We also have a really neat video on the Kombucha Brewers International YouTube channel that sort of talks about the origins of kombucha. That's really neat that you can share, very short, 1 minute long, and we can drop links in the show notes for that. And then, yeah, it's just sharing a kombucha, sharing your love of kombucha, photos of you drinking kombucha. If you've got a little kombucha ditty that you want to share, I mean, really, I think of kombucha as a really fun, entertaining, social, like you've heard my little kombucha songs. I feel like almost any song can be turned to.
Yes. Oh, I love doing that too. I have one actually.
Yeah, let's hear it. What is it?
Okay, well, it's a little esoteric, but I don't know if you remember those old Nintendo cereal commercials.
Nintendo cereal commercials?
Yeah, there's like a Nintendo cereal commercial. Well, like, Nintendo, it's for breakfast now. So I thought, like, you could do it with kombucha. Like, kombucha, it's a beverage. Wow.
Yeah, it's for breakfast now. It's a beverage.
Right? Yeah, actually, kombucha, it's for breakfast now. Kombucha, it's a beverage. Wow.
Exactly right. And I think that that kind of creativity is just emblematic of kombucha. It's all about diversity. It's all about that creative spirit, that energy, that sort of life force that comes from consuming life, and in this case, microbes. And so, yeah, those are the ways to celebrate it. It's just... share your love of kombucha, whether that's a picture of you drinking your favorite brand or you in your home brew, whatever it is. It's just like plastering social media with your favorite images of kombucha so that we spread that message far and wide.
Love it. So just about out of time, but before we go, let the listeners know where they can find the website for Kombucha Camp and learn more information about your business.
Kombucha Camp, camp with a K, because we're cute and clever over here. Kombucha is K-O-M-B-U-C-H-A, camp, K-A-M-P.com. If you're looking to find your favorite brands, go to kombuchabrewers.org. And of course, worldkombuchaday.com now exists. So check out the website there. We're going to be posting a fun little logo, the hashtags, the videos there, events. We're starting to populate that with events. Come find everything you want for World Kombucha Day there.
Excellent. It's been a pleasure to have you here, and welcome as the first member of the five-time guest club.
Woohoo! Do I get like a special jacket? This is awesome.
Yeah, I think we got a pin in the works that we'll be sending you, and if we can see some photos of that, that would be great.
I think it just speaks to our long, evolving relationship around food, and I'm always grateful for you to provide a platform for me. So thank you so much, Aaron. Really appreciate you.
It's been great.
That's all for this episode of The Appropriate Omnivore. I'll be back later this month to interview members of the Truly Grass-Fed team as we talk about their amazing grass-fed cheese and butter. To make sure you never miss any of my podcasts, go to iTunes and subscribe to The Appropriate Omnivore. You can also listen to all of my podcasts at the website appropriateomnivore.com. There you can find recipes from the guests I interview, plus all of my articles covering lifestyles in the world of real food. I'll see you later this month. Until then, my pantry is officially closed.